2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 271, Real Goddesses Have Curves and Identities, a panel featuring Holly Welker, Doe Daughtry, Maxine Hanks, Jana Bauch-Remy, Mary Ellen Robertson, and Margaret M. Toscano.
Sessions is going to be on the disappearance of the Heavenly Mother. This year we're talking about women's place in the Mormon Church, tackling the tough issues. Does the proclamation on the family make women second-class citizens? Is priesthood only for men? Why aren't we angry? And what happened to the Heavenly Mother? So anybody interested, I'm going to put the flyers in the back.
Surge protector right back there for us. But that's... Yeah, so go plug in.
Connect it.
Jana, Remy. Nice to meet you.
All right, so despite the fact that things are still going on, we're going to go ahead and start because the hour has come. This platform has become so rickety. If we suddenly disappear, well, it means the platform broke or God got mad, so we'll see. This morning I had the privilege of... I guess I'm supposed to announce the session. This is 271, Real Goddesses Have Curves and Identities. This morning I had the privilege of being on a really terrific panel called Doing Things That Change Us, Religion is Practice. And I would encourage all of you to go listen to the tape, but unfortunately it didn't record. But it was really very affirming. People talked about the aspects of Mormonism that helped them become better people regardless of issues of belief and faith. And afterwards I commented that it was really kind of cool to have an opportunity to celebrate the very best things in Mormonism, especially for people like me who don't attend church anymore, are no longer believers. However, this is not one of those panels where we celebrate what's best about Mormonism. This is one of the panels where we ask questions and think about what is lacking. And I want to start with a visualization. So I would like you to close your eyes and envision a goddess. If there's a ready-made image of a goddess that you like, Botticelli's Birth of Venus, for instance, go ahead and call it to mind. If not, take some time to create your own vision of the divine feminine. What is this goddess's skin color? What's her body like? What's her age? How is she dressed? None. What expression is she wearing? What about her psychological makeup? What are her defining characteristics? What activities does she engage in? What feelings does she inspire in you? Okay, now erase that image and instead imagine a demoness, the most dreadful demoness you can conjure, and answer the same questions. What's her skin color? What's her body like? What's her age? How is she dressed? What color is her hair and how is it done? What expression is she wearing? What are her defining characteristics? What activities does she engage in? What feelings does she inspire in you? All right, now unfortunately I'm very low tech, so I'm going to show you a picture which most of you in the back probably can't see, but I do have a description written up. But I just take a look at this picture and tell me if it matches more closely the goddess or the demoness you just envisioned. Okay? For those of you at the back or for people listening on tape, if this is recorded this time, I'll describe this picture, okay? First of all, her skin is baby blue. She has 10 arms, which she uses to hold several weapons, including a sword, a bow and arrow, a scimitar, a trident, and a spiked shield. With yet another hand, she raises a severed human head by its hair, below which, held by yet another hand, is a bowl to collect the fresh blood gushing from the neck. Her long tongue protrudes from her mouth, and if you look closely, you can see that she has fangs. She wears a necklace of human skulls, a skirt made from severed human and still more severed, made from severed human arms and still more severed heads, and she stands atop an enemy she has vanquished, a fairly normal-looking man clad in a leopard skin loincloth. This particular painting reveals her as quite curvy with full breasts, but she is often depicted as emaciated. Sorry, changing pages. Her hair here is curly and flowing rather than matted and wild, as you might see in other images of her. She is often shown with eyes rolling from drunkenness brought on by consuming human blood. Her name means devourer of time. Anybody, aside from these panelists, know who she is? Kali, exactly. And she is what? Hindu goddess. Okay, she is not a demoness, despite her horrific appearance. And despite the fact that Kali is a goddess, I do not revere her, and I am not suggesting that we should worship her or become thugs, an English word for cutthroat or ruffian derived from the name of a group of assassins in northern India who worshipped Kali and offered her their victims. I don't want to be a thug. But the fact remains that I find Kali fascinating, as well as terrifying and revolting, which is precisely the point. What fascinates me most is that she is not a demoness. She is a goddess, a manifestation of powers perceived as fundamentally divine, fundamentally female, and fundamentally terrifying, specifically the realities of death and time, and the frightening, painful side of life which all who desire to progress spiritually must face and overcome. Why are the realities of death and time and the frightening, painful side of life seen as divine and not demonic? Because they are the destroyers of ignorance. They are what awaken human beings to the deeper truths of life. They are what help us understand that we must lay not up for ourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal, but lay up for ourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through and steal. For where our treasure is, there will our hearts be also. Which, in case you couldn't tell, is Matthew 6:19-21. I am not an expert on Hinduism. I have never been to India. I rely on basic research, which tells me that in the minds of many men, women also constitute a special force and power, the dynamic part of the cosmos, life-giving energy. They are so much this divine force or Shakti that, as Indian men occasionally say, they don't need any ritual. In other words, women don't need ritual, but they do need help. I found very depressing data on the status of women, even today, of murders of wives whose dowries were too small. If the wife dies, you don't have to send the dowry back, but you can go out and get another richer wife. of beatings and brutalities and rapes. I learned that historically, although the divine models such as Kali and other goddesses may have been there as potential resources, the situation on the ground has not provided any possibility for women to appropriate them, though apparently that is changing. And today, it is now possible for Hindu women not only to consciously draw upon goddess mythology in redefining their place in society, but also to pursue the options that this mythology, coupled with institutional support, provides. In other words, in India, women's supposed divine feminine power has been used to justify denying them any real power in the world and has not prevented their victimization and abuse, a personal and political injustice women are now seeking to rectify. Does this by any chance sound familiar? Last week, a reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune emailed me and asked me how I came up with the idea for this panel. I'll give you the details I wouldn't give her, which is that it's John Remy's fault. In April, he emailed half a dozen Mormon feminists he knew, saying he was on a quest for the divine feminine, asking for insight and assistance. I had a hard time deciding what to tell him. In the years since I gave up being a practicing and believing Mormon, I have begun to think of God as something like this. God with a small g equals the logic of karma. God equals the reason that every action has a reaction and that every single act, thought, inaction, moment of carelessness, belief, speech, gesture has a consequence. God is not the instigator of karma, nor the enforcer of consequence. God is not the one who creates the laws governing the universe. God is the laws themselves, and the desire to live close to the laws, in harmony with them, appreciating their mystery and striving to understand it, is the divine. Mystics write about a God who would most properly be described as simultaneously both male and female, as well as neither male nor female. And the whole point of such a description is that we can't understand it by exploring and explaining it with any of the faculties, methods, or terms we use to describe and understand ourselves. We have to develop a different consciousness for an encounter with such an experience, not only so it can be meaningful, but so it can happen in the first place. The more I read about this mystical concept of the divine, the more I think this is one way the Old Testament myths got it right. When, in response to his question, "Who are you?" Moses hears, "I am that I am," what that power really is saying is, "I am to be. I am a verb, not a noun." And that's why it's blasphemous to pin it down with a name, because it's not a thing or an entity that can be pinned down. So I wrote back to John and told him, "I'm not much interested in the divine feminine as opposed to the divine in general. I used to be more interested in the divine feminine back when I was a practicing Mormon, since Mormonism so devalues and trivializes the divine feminine and makes the divine masculine so robustly authoritarian and nasty. But when I quit thinking that the divine has a penis, I quit thinking that it lacked a vulva. I work hard not to assign the divine a gender, and in some ways I feel it's artificial to look for the divine feminine when the human feminine is so minimized and trivialized in our lives. The real reason there is this talk about the divine masculine and the divine feminine is because the masculine divine is shorthand for power, for the ways in which worshiping a white heterosexual man has disempowered everyone who isn't a white heterosexual man. But it doesn't really help us understand anything about the divine, just about our own relationship to power, though I will admit that is a useful thing to understand. Today I say, indeed it is. You can look at goddesses and consider how female power is either nurturing or threatening. Do real women fail to claim their own power because they're afraid of it? If they claim it, do they exercise it with kindness and wisdom or with caprice and carelessness? And how does an understanding of the complex nature of power help us learn something fundamental about the way the universe works, regardless of whether or not we believe there is some being in the sky calling the shots? As I mentioned, I think of God more as an experience or an energy than an entity. And I believe that every depiction of gods and goddesses, from Elohim, the Mormon father in heaven, to Kali, the Hindu destroyer of time, is a metaphor, if not an idol, because it's a created, contained, physical representation of that which is too great, too vast, too incomprehensible to be named or defined. But metaphors can be pretty darn powerful tools for understanding. Furthermore, my discussion with John occurred just as I began reading The Dance of the Dissident Daughter by Sue Monk Kidd, where I found this passage. What reasons were there for recovering the lost goddess besides the mystery and love she ignited in the female heart, besides all those unsayable reasons that live in a woman's soul? I tried to get pragmatic. First, I noted that the lack of a divine female image supported an imbalance in our consciousness that diminished our wholeness as persons. The feminine goes underground in our psyche, just as it does in our God. When this happens, we exclude, overlook, and undervalue the feminine within ourselves and in the world around us. Not only that, but as long as we have a divine father who is able to create without a divine mother, women's creative acts are viewed as superfluous or secondary. And as long as the feminine is missing in the divine, men would continue to experience entitlement, and women would be prey to self-doubt and disempowerment. It was that simple. Internalizing the divine feminine provides women with the healing affirmation that they are persons in their own right, that they can make choices, that they are worthy and entitled and do not need permission. The internalization of the sacred feminine tells us that our gender is a valuable and marvelous thing to be. It suggests the goodness of female sexuality and the equal authority of all the experiences of women. After reading that, I decided I would do well to ponder this issue more, see what it has to say to me. And when I considered my own religious traditions, I realized that Mother in Heaven was not an idea of the divine feminine I wanted to reclaim or internalize. She strikes me as the deification of the Victorian ideal of the angel in the house, a self-effacing presence who asks nothing, sacrifices everything, and is as close as a human being can come to being devoid of parts and passions. No, for ideas of the feminine divine that had something to say to me, I'd have to look outside Christianity for goddesses with bodies and curves and personalities and names, goddesses who helped me think in complex and sophisticated ways about the mystery that is the divine, rather than simply being a big mystery themselves. So I thought I'd follow John's example and ask Mormon women what they had to say about goddesses who inspire them. And this was supposed to be the segue where I turn time over to my panelists, but I've been asked to tell a story. And if everyone gets out and walks out after I tell this, I have no one to blame except those women who told me to tell it. So, all right. I was talking the other night about this panel and the name for it, and said that I myself had another name for it, which comes from Sandra Bernhardt. If any of you are familiar with her work, she did a movie called Without You, I'm Nothing, and she used to be on Married with Children, and she was in The King of Comedy. She likes music, and she was railing against artists like Avril Lavigne, these very anemic young women. And she said, "Give me Anne and Nancy Wilson of Heart. Those old rockers, they can eat these young things for breakfast." She said, "Give me the sweaty, big-tittied bitches of rock and roll." And I said that I think of this panel as the sweaty, big-tittied bitches of paganism. So, you're all still here. And now, with that in mind, I'll turn the time over to Jana. Jana, do you want it brought to you, or do you want to get up? Okay. It might be. Okay, why? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's too late now.
Okay, no, I'm okay. There.
Oh, we can just move it. We'll just move it.
Actually, I'd rather stand.
Okay.
I think we need a housekeeper up here for all of our equipment. My computer's coming to life, I hope. There. I think. There we go. All right, while I pull up my thing, I'll just start by saying how pleased I am to be on this panel. It is my husband's fault, and unfortunately my husband is speaking next door right now, so he's not here, and I wish he could be here because he really did want to be, but, you know, can't be two places at once. All right. Today I'm going to speak about Inanna, who's the queen of heaven and earth in the Sumerian pantheon. So she was a goddess with great status and power. Many tales about her recall the time that she chose to abandon her royal office and descend to the underworld. Her trip down under is prompted by the cries of pain that she hears from her sister, Ereshkigal, who is the goddess of the underworld. Just as an aside, I don't know that I'm pronouncing these names correctly. I'm doing my best. I quote from Inanna's myth. From the great above, she opened her ears to the great below. From the great above, the goddess opened her ears to the great below. From the great above, Inanna opened her ears to the great below. My lady, abandon heaven and earth to descend to the underworld. Inanna, abandon heaven and earth to descend to the underworld. She abandoned her office of holy priestess to descend to the underworld. I'm not an expert on Inanna or Sumerian mythology. My experience with Inanna is personal. I encountered the story of her descent during a time that I was suffering from depression. As I read about Inanna, I felt her story paralleled my own underworldly experience. So in my talk today, I'll tell you a little bit about the Inanna story and how it was and still is meaningful to me. My depression occurred while I was a stay-at-home mom, and my husband held a demanding job where he was rarely home. At this time, my identity was primarily defined by my relationships to others. I was a mother, a housewife, a daughter, a young women's leader, etc. I was caught up in the hum of daily life and had very little time for myself. My life had lost the luster and spark that made me want to get out of bed in the morning. At the same time, I had an emotional break, a betrayal from a trusted male family member, which left me obsessively angry at him and also thrust me into a downward spiral of despair and insecurity. At first glance, Inanna couldn't be farther from me, a 21st century Mormon woman. Inanna was a queen, and importantly, she was a queen whose value was not tied to her role as a maternal goddess. Like Athena, she was the goddess of war. Like Aphrodite, she was the goddess of love. Yet there came a time that Inanna began to feel, in this myth story, there came a time that she began to feel uneasy. She heard the cries of pain from her sister, Ereshkigal, the goddess of the underworld, and she decided she would make a journey to the underworld to see why her sister was suffering. Many interpretations of the Inanna story explain that her desire to visit her sister's kingdom was because she wanted knowledge of the underworld. Prior to her descent, she is described as pure and naive. Many writers also point out that Inanna's sister is merely a mirror of Inanna herself, so her journey to the underworld can be viewed as a journey to gain self-knowledge, to understand her darker side, or her shadow self. Inanna's descent to the underworld is, in some ways, a Dante-esque parallel to the temple experience. In contrast to the temple where a patron moves symbolically upward in a journey to the celestial kingdom, and in the process dons symbolic priestly clothing, Inanna is stripped piece by piece of her royal robes and all of her identifying jewelry as she moves systematically downward through the gates of the underworld. At each of these gates, Inanna asks questions and seeks to understand what is happening to her. But instead of receiving further light and knowledge from her journey, Inanna is told she must not question what is happening to her. I'll read from her experience at the first two underworld gates. When she entered the first gate, from her head the crown was removed. Inanna asked, "What is this?" She was told, "Quiet, Inanna, the ways of the underworld are perfect. They may not be questioned." When she entered the second gate, from her neck the small lapis beads were removed. Inanna asked, "What is this?" She was told, "Quiet, Inanna, the ways of the underworld are perfect. They may not be questioned." The process then continues through seven gates. Ereshkigal, who has orchestrated Inanna's underworldly striptease, explains the systematic removal of Inanna's clothing is so the holy priestess of heaven will enter the underworld bowed low. Ereshkigal's desire to humiliate Inanna stems from her worries that Inanna seeks to take over the underworld. Therefore, when Ereshkigal sees her sister naked and vulnerable, she is not compassionate towards her. Instead, she condemns her to death. The myth states, "Then Ereshkigal, the goddess of the underworld, fastened on Inanna the eye of death. She spoke against her the word of wrath. She uttered against her the cry of guilt. She struck her. Inanna was turned into a corpse, a piece of rotting meat, and was hung from a hook on the wall." I compared Inanna's loss of queenly stature and power to my own struggle with depression. I saw myself as someone who was defined almost exclusively from the outside by others through my familial and social roles. In my depression, I no longer found value in these outward trappings of identity. And like Inanna's darker sister self, my self-critic, my internal censor, told me that I was guilty, that the bad things that had happened in my life were all my fault, that I deserved to be unhappy and miserable. My inner voice echoed the condemnation of Ereshkigal when it told me I was worthless, a husk of a person or a soulless corpse. Inanna hung on the hook in the underworld for 3 days. Then her servant, who was waiting patiently for her to return, realized that something had gone wrong and sought out help from other gods. The servant pleads with these other gods, "Do not let the holy priestess of heaven be put to death in the underworld." And each of these gods in turn answer, "Inanna craved the great above. Inanna craved the great below. She who receives the gifts of the underworld does not return. She who goes to the dark city stays there." Eventually, Inanna's servant finds a compassionate god who creates two minions to rescue her queen. However, as these minions enter the gates of the underworld, they encounter Ereshkigal writhing in pain. The minions, on the advice of their master, listen to Ereshkigal's cries of pain and echo her expressions. The myth reads, "Like flies, they slip through the cracks of the gates. They entered the throne room of the queen of the underworld. No linen was spread on her body. Her breasts were uncovered. Her hair swirled around her head like leeks. Ereshkigal was moaning, 'Oh, oh, my inside.' They moaned, 'Oh, oh, your inside.' She moaned, 'Oh, oh, my outside.' They moaned, 'Oh, oh, your outside.' She groaned, 'Oh, oh, my belly.' They groaned, 'Oh, oh, your belly.' She groaned, 'Oh, oh, my back.' They groaned, 'Oh, oh, your back.' And then she sighed, 'Ah, ah, my heart.' Their compassion to Ereshkigal heals her pain. She discovers that she only needed the love and recognition of another to be free of her distress. In gratitude, she offers these minions a gift. She says to them, 'Who are you, moaning, groaning, sighing with me? If you are gods, I will bless you. If you are mortals, I will give you a gift. What do you wish?' They answered, 'We wish only for the corpse that hangs from the hook on the wall.' Ereshkigal said that the corpse belongs to Inanna. They said, 'Whether it belongs to our queen, whether it belongs to our king, that is what we wish. Give it to us.' When they receive Inanna's body, they bring her back to life." Now, to relate this section of the myth to my own experience, like Ereshkigal's pain, I was feeling the loss of my identity, and I needed the help of others to hear my pain and to show empathy for my experience. Fortunately, like Inanna's servant, I had the blessing of some friends who were concerned about me and continued to be empathetic to my pain. While I was suffering depression, I became ill with chronic bronchitis and laryngitis. For several months, I could hardly speak without choking and couldn't talk louder than a whisper. I realized that my inability to speak was linked to my emotional pain, and it drove me further into despair as I lost the ability to carry on a simple conversation. Yet one day, perhaps on a whim, I bought a piano. I had learned to play as a child, and I thought that if I could play some music, it might comfort me. Soon I began playing simple songs, and I would whisper the lyrics as I played. My favorite became one of Enya's songs, and I'll read you a few of the words. I think this will be hard. "Through all the tumult and the strife, I hear its music ringing. It sounds an echo in my soul. How can I keep from singing? While though the tempest loudly roars, I hear the truth, it liveth. And though the darkness round me close, songs in the night it giveth." The songs I played became the cries of pain, like those of Ereshkigal. As I played and sang the songs, even in my hesitant voice, I found the comfort I had craved. I began to discover the self-love I had lost, and it gave me the glimmer of hope that I would overcome my underworldly experience. Now, returning back to Inanna's story. Though Inanna was resurrected from her death in the underworld, she was still trapped in the lower kingdom, unless she could find someone to take her place. The myth explains, "But as Inanna was about to ascend from the underworld, the judges of the underworld seized her. Who has ever ascended unscathed from the underworld? If Inanna is to ascend from the underworld, let her provide a substitute for herself." Eventually, a bargain is struck with the underworld judges, and Inanna's husband, Dumuzi, who is portrayed as a faithless husband because he doesn't look for her while she is gone, takes Inanna's place in the underworld for 6 months of the year, and Inanna is allowed to return to her throne. The myth tells of Inanna's encounter with Dumuzi when she sentences him to take her place in the lower kingdom. Dumuzi, the husband of Inanna, was dressed in his shining garments. He sat on his magnificent throne. Inanna fastened on Dumuzi the eye of death. She spoke against him the word of wrath. She uttered against him the cry of guilt. "Take him away, take Dumuzi away." The Gala seized Dumuzi. They made him stand up. They made him sit down. They beat the husband of Inanna. They gashed him with axes. Dumuzi let out a wail. The words of Inanna's condemnation of Dumuzi are almost the same as that of her own death sentences at Ereshkigal's hand. Inanna, in condemning her husband, gained some vengeance for her own painful death. I related this section of the myth to my own pain when I was betrayed by a family member. In my mind, Dumuzi became a symbol of the person who had hurt me. I could see that Dumuzi's banishment to the underworld was the result of his selfishness. He thought only of himself and didn't worry about Inanna's disappearance. Likewise, I realized that I did not need to suffer for the selfish mistake of someone else. He was responsible for his choice, and I could free myself by recognizing that I no longer needed to blame myself for what had happened. I realized that the whole situation was not really about me. It was not my responsibility to feel guilty about what had happened. It was not my fault. My discussion of Inanna will end now, as the myth ends with her resuming her former status. As I close, I want to point out that I've taken Inanna's story completely out of context, with very little cultural or historical understanding for the time period in which it was produced. The rational part of me, the historian in me, says this is irresponsible, even silly, to take an ancient story and pretend it applies to me. However, the Mormon side of me has been doing this for years, taking scripture verses and likening them to myself. And because of the dearth of scriptures that discuss women, that give voice to women's experiences, I've appropriated Inanna's story and made it a chapter in my own personal book of scripture. Though I don't plan to quote from it in Sunday school, I have to admit it's quite tempting. One more note before I close. While the Inanna story was an important archetype for me as I battled depression, it was not the only factor which helped in my healing. For those of you who've experienced depression, you might find it unrealistic that a story could be a healing influence in such a dark time. However, for me, the story of Inanna held great power. It was a narrative that I repeated to myself over and over, that a goddess had gone to the underworld, had died, and had lived again. As I repeated this as a mantra during my darkest days, I could see my own self returning too, and it made all the difference for me. Thank you.
Feeling a little seasick from the podium. When Holly asked me to participate in this panel, I wasn't sure where my opinions would fit. My degree in women's studies and religion introduced me to many new goddess figures and the female divine in other religious traditions, more so than my upbringing as a Mormon did. And I love learning about the Mesoamerican Brujas, the creative and furious Kali, and Mother Mary's devoted following in many parts of the world. And again, even though I found these figures admirable and interesting, they didn't seem to provide what I felt was missing from my own spiritual life. And as I analyze this, I wonder if I'm falling into the all-too-common trap of believing the divine to be remote or unknowable for a profane being like myself, or perhaps I miss the larger point when I insist that a divine feminine figure feel real to me. Although I enjoyed learning about the divine feminine in other religious traditions, this didn't seem to make the connection with the divine feminine in Mormon tradition feel any more real to me either. I've tried praying to Mother in Heaven. I've tried visualizing her. I've tried imagining what it would be like to have her more involved in the workings of the church and in my personal life. But my attempts to make her a more tangible figure seem to have fallen flat, as much as I would desire that female figure in my life. In spite of my feminist leanings and my academic studies, Mother in Heaven just hasn't been a really galvanizing force for me, and I feel a lot of tension internally about that. I'd like it to be true, but it doesn't feel true for me. And I wonder if it has anything to do with my often difficult relationship with my actual mother, and it makes me wonder how we create healthy concepts of of heavenly parents when our relationships with our earthly parents might be a little difficult. I might not be the only person affected by this phenomenon. So it's just something I think about. although my search for the female divine that feels comfortable, that feels like home to me, although that search is ongoing, I have found something to tide me over in the meantime, and that is jewelry. And before you start asking what I smoked on the way to this session, let me explain how jewelry fits into my spiritual paradigm. And in doing this, in creating this explanation, I borrow from and tweak a couple of theories from Colleen McDaniel's work, Material Christianity, and the objects that are often employed as part of people's spiritual lives. Anyone who's seen, purchased, or worn an Angel Moroni Tytac CTR ring, or young womanhood medallion can attest that these items serve a religious as well as a decorative function. And McDaniel points out that historically, icons and devotional objects help people contemplate the divine and teach true faith because not everyone can approach God through the intellect. The uneducated women and children were particularly responsive to sacred images, objects, and spaces. And if some dead male theologian said that was true, it must be true, right? But I think her underlying point is that that not everyone approaches God in the same way. And for some people, religious objects or artifacts become what's significant, become their doorway to the religious, to the spiritual. So back to the jewelry. A friend of mine is a gifted healer, therapist, and energy psychology practitioner. And she decided to start a side business selling jewelry. Not just any kind of jewelry, but jewelry made with semi-precious gemstones whose properties specifically enhance and amplify feminine energy and correspond with one or more chakras. She calls her collection of jewelry the Goddess Collection. And about once a month, she displays and sells her wares. Since Paula launched the Goddess Collection, I've been a regular worshiper, customer, whatever you want to call it, and I've arrived at this conclusion. Real goddesses know how to accessorize. While I may not be able to connect as directly with, you know, other goddess figures from other religious traditions, jewelry I can get into. Even if I don't subscribe to all the tenets of energy psychology or some of the New Age leaning aspects of this, the jewelry itself is gorgeous, and I feel better when I wear it than when I don't wear it. And I actually stopped on the way to this session and picked up this in the lovely shop around the corner. So I was drawn to it. The Goddess Collection, let me tell you a little bit more about the stones that that Paula specializes in. The most commonly found stones in her collection are labradorite, rainbow moonstones, blister pearl, amethyst, citrine amber, and a handful of others as she comes across them. Each piece of jewelry that you purchase comes with a little card describing the energetic properties of the piece that you purchased. And she also does readings on each individual piece of jewelry that you buy, which is also interesting. It's a little bit more personal, I don't know, like a matriarchal blessing over the jewels, something like that. Some of the things that she sells, amber promotes healing, absorbs negative energy, and helps the wearer create balance in her life, and it corresponds to the solar plexus chakra. Labradorite, the other thing around my neck, is also known as the Merlin stone, and it aids in mental clarity and self-awareness, enhances comfort with the unknown, and promotes the appreciation of the hidden life within. And it corresponds to the root, brow, and crown chakras. Rainbow Moonstone, the one at my wrist, supports feminine energy, assists in physical, emotional, and hormonal healing and balancing, and resonates with nurturing mother love, beauty, mystery of the feminine, and goddess energy. And I guess that's my goddess stone, my way into the topic. And there are several others that also have properties that I found kind of interesting. Many sources, especially online, explain more about the energy enhancing properties of various gemstones, if you'd like to know more. And in one book that Paula describes, there's also some information on sacred geometry, that the shape of the stone is also significant. And I think there's something about the process of adornment that brings out the best in us. I don't know about you, but I've never seen a representation of a goddess schlepping around in sweatpants. Even in our little visualization, that's not what I see. Instead, they're adorned in finery. They have robes, jewels, gold and silver amulets, tools, weapons. Everything is pretty much top of the line. And imagine yourself, for a moment, dressed in your favorite outfit, one that you really own or would like to. And don't you feel great about yourself when you have that special outfit on? What if you could feel that way every day? And if you could mentally or physically put on goddess regalia regardless of what you're actually wearing. Even when I'm schlubbing around in a t-shirt and denim, I feel more goddess-like if I've got some of my jewelry on. Rainbow moonstones, amber, labradorite. And the energy I feel and radiate is different when I have some of these pieces on. And again, I don't know that I completely always buy into, you know, the energetic properties of things. But on some level, I do think there's significance there. And I feel, like I said, I feel better when I have it on. And for some of us, it might be a sumptuous sweater. It might be a pair of high heels that make your legs look like Tina Turner, a signature scent or a color that brings out your spark of radiance. And I don't think that we should underestimate the power of these small acts of beautification and enhancement, because I think they really do feed in to a more grounded, full appreciation of the divine in you and the divine in all of us. And I think despite our outward appearances or our ability to bedeck ourselves in things that make us feel and look good, our real strength, of course, is internal. And I also believe that anything we do to honor and enhance the divine being within ourselves makes us stronger inside as well as out. So I maintain in some small way that adorning myself, adorning ourselves, is one way that we can connect to the divine feminine. Colleen McDaniel points out that it is the continual interactions with objects and images that makes one religious in a particular manner. If so, then I'm religious or spiritual in a way that celebrates the beauty of the natural world by wearing some of its beautiful creations as jewelry. In this way, these objects take on meaning and become part of my spiritual life. I probably won't get up in testimony meeting and bear testimony of how my goddess collection jewelry has enhanced my spiritual well-being. I'll just wear it and enjoy what it does for me and the way that it enhances my body and my spirit when I have it on.
Thank you, Maxine. Voila.
Very good. Okay. Just a week ago, I was in Mesa, Arizona, with my younger sister, Susan, who is very rapidly dying of cancer, a cancer she has been battling for almost 10 years now. I felt privileged to be able to wash her disease-ridden body. She is painfully thin, but the beauty of her face and her breasts and her legs assaulted my grief. Even her feet are bony, but they still retain their characteristic and delicate prettiness. I told her she's always had such pretty feet. Someone had painted her toenails. Better not get too close. Someone had painted her toenails a deep, rich maroon color, I'm sure to cheer her spirits. But daily, the bright color stands in sharper contrast with the growing pallor of her skin. In spite of her strong faith and will to live, I fear, but I still pray, that she will go quickly. My own sometimes fading faith still believes strongly in the immortality of the soul, but I am left to contemplate the meaning of Susan's too brief stay in a womanly tabernacle of flesh and bones and blood. Feminist theologians argue about the problem of God and gender. Which is more beneficial to women? A God who is beyond gender, which Holly argued for, a divine power or being that transcends the categories of human experience? Or is it better for women's position if God is androgynous, a mixture of masculine and feminine? Or is the third alternative better? And there may be others too. But this third alternative is that God is multiple, male and female, God and goddess. Now, I don't have time to go through the strengths and weaknesses of each of these positions, but surely there are good and bad about each of the positions. So while I think on one level that God surely must be complex enough to encompass all of these possibilities, I'm one of those that has a hard time choosing between what is your favorite. I always like all. But still, I hold to the belief that only an embodied God can redeem and make sense out of human embodiment. And maybe that embodiment is only in images, but it's still the material nature of experience that Mary Ellen talked about, I think, means that we have to make sense out of embodiment. Why have a body at all if the final goal is to escape it completely? And yet the problem for women is that we are so often reduced to our bodies. Biology becomes our destiny, as the old saying goes. The LDS Proclamation on the Family states that women are primarily responsible. Well, I got ahead of myself, but that's okay. Are primarily responsible for nurturing children. The implication of this seems to be that Heavenly Mother's role, too, is limited to bearing and nurturing children. Although I wonder why she has been forbidden to nurture her children on earth through prayer. While the Mormon doctrine of an embodied God can be a remedy for the traditional Christian view that denigrates the physical world, unfortunately, it is used instead to project into eternity the most narrow view of what women can be here. Goddesses from other traditions, and here's one, inspire me because they offer a model, or many models, for escaping two false dichotomies. The dichotomy that makes us choose between heaven and earth, that is, between transcendence and immanence, again, I want both, and the dichotomy that makes us choose between motherhood and any other role for women outside the domestic sphere. I love the rich variety of goddesses, ancient and modern, European and Asian. And Inanna happens to be one of my favorites too. She's inspired me. But today, I will focus on the ancient Greek goddesses. Now, I'm sure they're probably the most familiar to you. Everybody's read about them, and I teach about them. But I thought they would be a good way to illustrate my premise that goddesses with curves, and this goddess has plenty, do not reduce women to their reproductive parts, but rather help us negotiate some thorny theological and personal problems. Many scholars believe that all of the Greek goddesses were originally fertility figures derived from the prehistoric great goddess that you see here, who encompassed the full range of divine powers and functions. But over time, these functions were divided among multiple goddesses who each took one or more of the original panoply of gifts. Nevertheless, each goddess retained some of the power of fertility. Remember that fertility in this context does not simply mean popping babies out as quickly as possible. Rather, fertility has to do with an abundance of those things that make life worthwhile and enjoyable. It is the power over life and death which belongs to the male god alone in the Christian tradition. In contrast, the Greek goddesses control as many vital aspects of life as their male counterparts. This is Aphrodite. But I'm going to now move to Hera, who is the goddess of marriage and is obviously connected with fertility. But she is also a powerful queen who rules over humans and gods. Even Zeus fears her wrath. You may remember her jealous rage over Zeus's many affairs. Now, actually, this is not Zeus that she's killing in this particular one or wounding. It's a giant, and she has this great power. But while such stories of this jealousy of Hera in their patriarchal versions are not always flattering to Hera, they show her just indignation and fight for women's rights in marriage and society. Here she is with Zeus. The struggle between Hera and Zeus represents the ongoing conflict between matriarchal and patriarchal powers that must be balanced for the sacred marriage, or hieros gamos, that we've heard about at this conference. And this depicts both the tension and the marriage itself. So in order for that to be achieved, Hestia, who's the goddess on the right, is the goddess of the hearth, and she's the most domestic of the Greek goddesses. She is rarely pictured in myth or in art because her duty to keep the home fires burning makes her a vigilant protector of the private realm. Fire is a form of fertility, nevertheless, because it is needed to cook food and provide light and warmth. Demeter here is the earth mother who pours forth an abundance of fruits and grains onto a needy world. As the mistress of the seasons, she displays cosmic power over the elements. She is also a teacher of men as she instructs them how to use the science of agriculture to make the seasons work for their human benefit. She and her daughter Persephone act as savior goddesses on many levels. They play the role in Greek religion that Christ plays in Christianity as they mediate between heaven and earth and offer hope to humans who are doomed to die. Those who are initiated into the mystery cult of these two goddesses, which is depicted here, are promised peace in this world and paradise in the next. Merciful and compassionate, Demeter and her daughter provide a sense of worth to the individual. The most androgynous of the Greek goddesses, Athena, also brings together in her person a mixture of what we term masculine and feminine traits. Although a warrior goddess, she also presides over the womanly arts of weaving and spinning. Her status as a virgin results from her own choice and represents women's power over their own bodies. Still, she is not unfruitful as the bearer of the olive tree, a gift whose oil provides food and fuel and acts as a cleansing agent. Athena is the epitome of intelligence, wisdom, and craftiness, showing women's connection with both rational and intuitive forms of knowledge. Another virgin, Artemis, also nurtures by protecting the animal kingdom. Her role as huntress is not simply to slaughter, but to mediate the complex interplay among predators and prey in the universal food chain cycle. Artemis is the original sports girl. She tromps through the woods with her band of girlfriends looking for adventure. While Aphrodite, as the goddess of beauty, represents all of those girly traits associated with primping and flirting, on a deeper level, she is primal desire itself. Her mirror, and this is actually an ancient mirror handle, and she's often associated with a mirror, the mirror is missing, is not merely about vanity, but about turning the gaze inward for introspection on one's true desires. Aphrodite gives to women the power to enjoy their sexuality. Not tied to one man, Aphrodite has the prerogative that men alone have in a patriarchal world. That is, she is free to explore her erotic nature in many different ways. However, she's not without a sense of responsibility because she is also the mother of heroes like Aeneas and must think about the results of her actions. She can be modest, as she is here, as well as erotically free and naked. She can heal the split between the Madonna and whore, which I think she brings together here. The curvaceous Greek goddesses offer many possibilities for women. None of them is exclusively relegated to the private sphere, not even Hestia. And none of them have to choose between fertility and other parts of their natures. This is the worst aspect of the current Mormon view on women's roles, in my opinion. We women are pitted against each other and our own inner selves because we are told that motherhood alone can satisfy us and that our desires should not go very far beyond the domestic. And if we object to this idea, then we are accused of being against motherhood and being critical of our sisters who don't work outside the home. This is a picture of my sister Susan and her two youngest daughters. I saw my sister Susan struggle with this conflict on her deathbed when I was there with her. She is a mother of 8 children who have been the center of her life. So you can imagine the agony she is feeling at leaving them behind. Here she is with her two youngest just a couple of months ago. Her wig hides the signs of her cancer. Kyla, the baby of the family, the one on the bottom, is only 7. The extreme test of Susan's faith is to understand how God could ask her to leave her mothering role for someone else to complete. And the other side of her agony is that she feels cheated, too, that she never got to explore so many of her other desires. She confided in me that she feels her personhood got lost over the years, and that she was trapped in everyone else's expectations for her. Trapped, too, because she wasn't even allowed to question. Otherwise, she might have become an apostate like her sisters Janice and Margaret. So it is for you, Susan, that I seek the many faces of the goddess. It is for you that I seek to free the Heavenly Mother from our narrow view of what the divine feminine is or should be. Thanks.
Just been crying at everything today. It's not fair. I never cry. I must be really too tired. I'm wondering if I could, it's because I don't have a printer with me, and one year I actually paid $1 a page over there for a 30-page paper. I won't do that again. I'm wondering if I could go ahead and give my talk and then just real quickly run through the slides that I brought. Just have to bring it up now because I have it down. These sessions flow into each other. I don't know how best to think about that, whether to call it the collective unconscious, which scholars of religion have problems with, but which Western practitioners do appreciate, or synchronicity, or whatever. Regardless, something has happened here this week so that these sessions on the Divine Feminine are not repetitious, but they build on each other and they add to the whole. Before lunch, I attended Holly's panel discussion on religious practice, in which she argued very well that belief by itself is largely ineffective, but spiritual practice is what changes lives. When I talk about the goddess, I'm talking about Heavenly Mother. I believe in her. This is an LDS communal agreement about the nature of deity that gets expressed through LDS theological history and testimony. Most Mormons, I think, would admit to having a testimony that she exists somewhere in time and space. President Hinckley has stated that that sits well with him. However, he imposed a prohibition against elaborating on that belief to the extent that it becomes practice in the public sphere. So Heavenly Mother is relegated to the private sphere, which romanticists designate as the feminine sphere of influence. What I just said, in case you didn't catch it, is that any elaboration of Heavenly Mother passes from the realm of belief into the realm of practice. Yesterday, I talked about the importance of the visual in every aspect of my life. When scholars of religion discuss religious practice, even in non-Western traditions, we have to discuss the visual element of popular religion. Even Islam has a rich visual religious culture in which calligraphy is generative, breathing life into what is the word. And that creativity is not meant to be symbolic. We like that in the West. We really like to think that everything's symbolic of something else. No. In Catholicism, and particularly in Eastern Orthodoxy, images can be indexical, pointing to a particular truth, but the divine can also be literally present in the image. The visual is, to some extent, a reflection of belief, though that is complex, of course, and our language very well expresses what it means to judge a book by its cover. For instance, when we look at people and assume that their appearance reveals something to us about their beliefs. President Hinckley, for instance, is concerned with the generative capacity of appearance when he cautions against men wearing earrings or women wearing more than one and tattoos worn by both sexes. He is concerned with what that tells the world about us as a community, and as well as how those things might generate behavior in church members. I think this is especially evident in our elaboration of an anthropomorphic God. Because he is like us, we can picture him, we can image him, so that he becomes real to us. Imagining God generates reciprocity in our relationships with him. We most frequently image God as Mormons, God the Father, through the lens of the first vision, which implies that we can replicate Joseph's experience and have rich and true relationship with the Lord. I am wedded, against my will, to an anthropomorphic God. As a result, I'm also wedded to an anthropomorphic goddess. So I reached a moment in time when I had to visually express my culturally agreed upon belief in her. To do so, I turned to goddess imagery. Not just ancient goddess imagery, but contemporary goddess imagery. I bought figures. I bought prints, music, knickknacks, and books. I bought goddess key rings, jewelry, calendars, and tarot cards. In addition, Linda Sillitoe began making what she calls givers, which are women who, in the form of women, who I choose to interpret as goddesses. She made them out of clay and named according to the gift of insight that they brought to their might bring to their owners' lives. Are you surprised that I'm interested in religious material culture? No. What I was engaged in was the creation of identity. I wasn't worshiping the goddess or a goddess, but I was trying on different goddess identities to see which ones could be useful to me as I prayed and deliberated about the picture I wanted to see when I pictured my mother in heaven. I had previously been consumed with answering the question of what she was not to me, what I did not want her to be to me, and I finally turned to the question of what I did want her to be to me. It became ultimately a decision I made about my belief in her, because the only thing we can safely say about her in public is that she must be busily engaged in doing what married women everywhere should consider to be their primary role, birthing, nurturing, and raising children, and supporting her husband. And I actually had people tell me that when I was doing the research for my thesis. What does she do? What's her job? she's raising children and supporting her husband. I heard it over and over and over again. I had to go somewhere else to get images to articulate the wide range of human female experience and potential. I finally settled on a couple of goddesses that expressed to me the complexities of Heavenly Mother and of my own life. They all, coincidentally or not, turn out to be what are called triple goddesses, who express all aspects of a woman's life, from maiden, mother, to crone, darkness, and light. And the one that I wanted to share a little bit about with you today is Ixchel. Among the Maya of the Yucatan Peninsula, Ixchel was the name of the snake goddess of water and the moon, of childbirth and weaving. Huh. I am a Cancerian. I am a water baby. When I was 18 months old, my father took me to the town pool in the middle of nowhere in Texas, where he was managing the town pool. And from the age of 18 months, I was in the water. At the age of 2, I was diving off the high dive. I was a competitive swimmer in my teens. And now I am only most happy when I am either on the water in a boat. I really kind of am afraid of the water. I mean, I swim all the time, but I don't like water I can't see through. So the Caribbean is great for me. I don't like lakes, but if I'm on a boat or if I'm on an island, I am the happiest and I feel the safest. And I'm also a weaver. Once it was said she took the sun as her lover, but her grandfather hurled lightning jealously at her, killing the girl. Grieving dragonflies sang over Ixchel for 13 days, at the end of which time she emerged whole and alive and followed her lover to his palace. But there the sun in turn grew jealous of the goddess, accusing her of taking a new lover, his brother, the morning star. He threw Ixchel from heaven. She found sanctuary with a vulture divinity. The sun pursued and lured her home, but immediately he grew jealous again. Ixchel, weary of the sun's behavior, left his home and his bed to wander the night as she wished, making herself invisible whenever he came near. The night-riding goddess spent her energies in nursing the women of Earth through pregnancy and labor, taking special care of those who visited her sacred island of Cozumel. Ixchel was sometimes depicted as an old woman wearing a skirt with crossed bones, and she had a serpent in her hand. She sometimes wears a serpent on her head, representing her transformation from the winter to spring energy, shedding her winter skin in order to blossom anew into spring, to a new and fresh stage in the life cycle. She had an assistant sky serpent whom they believed carried all of the waters of the heavens in its belly. She is often shown carrying a great jug filled with water, which she overturns to send floods and powerful rainstorms to earth. She had a kinder side, so that she was and was worshipped as the protector of weavers and women in childbirth, so that she was depicted as being young and beautiful. Ixchel is a shapeshifter, consorting with the rabbit in spring. She is at once a maiden, a goddess of fertility of life, protector of women in childbirth, and a crone. The serpent reflects her status as a wise woman dispensing healing visions. She is the keeper of the life cycle, goddess of all new life, and keeper of the bones and souls of the dead. As a goddess, as a fertility goddess, her power waxes and wanes with the phases of the moon, mirroring the fertility cycle in the bodies of women. At this time, when the refreshing energy of spring coincides with the blue moon in November 2001, women invoke Ixchel's transformational fertile energy to shake off the winter slumber and launch into spring. Do I believe when I look at these images of Ixchel that this is my Heavenly Mother? No. What I see here is what I want to believe about her, as well as what I want to believe about myself, that we are both complex, capable, compassionate, and dangerous, and that I am an embryo full of her potential, that we are both goddesses. She is alive to me in a way that she has never been before. I hope that when I sing songs that contain her name, she hears me. When I weave at my loom, she is with me. When I nurture my daughters on their birthing beds, she attends us all. And when my body is dead, she will be the one who meets me and collects my bones, as I will collect the bones of my daughters who come after me. She is my mother, she is me. And I love her.
afraid I'm the literal embodiment of Holly's alternate title, which I won't repeat. At this very moment, the Olympic Summer Games in Athens, Greece are opening. And if you remember from the Olympics when they were here in Salt Lake, when the torch is lit to begin its route, it is lit by priestesses in a very elaborate and beautiful, well, simple ceremony in Greece. And I thought it was an interesting synchronicity that at this moment that torch is returning and the games are commencing in Athens. The scripture that was cited as the catalyst for Joseph Smith's vision of God, first vision, comes from the New Testament, James 1:5, which reads, "If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him." Joseph Smith said that never did any passage of Scripture come with more power to the heart of man than this did at this time to mine. It seemed to enter with great force into every feeling of my heart. I reflected on it again and again, knowing that if any person needed wisdom from God, I did. For how to act I did not know, and unless I could get more wisdom than I then had, I would never know. At length I concluded that at length I came to the determination to ask of God, concluding that if he gave wisdom to them that lacked wisdom and would give liberally and not upbraid, that I might venture. And so in accordance with this, my determination to ask of God, I retired to the woods to make the attempt. And we know how the story went. The visions that Joseph had of God were not only male. There is at least one vision recorded, I think, by Zebedee Coltrane, of a male and a female, a god and a goddess, seated on thrones together, side by side. So she's been there all along in Mormon tradition, but we don't really know who she is. We don't know her name, and we don't really have full access to her. In response to this problem and this need for her, I wrote in the Mormon Women's Forum quarterly in 1990, a column about theology, trying to encourage more discourse about the divine feminine or the mother in heaven. And I'm going to just excerpt a part of what I wrote. I was relaxing one day in November 1987, pondering the problem of women being treated as second-class citizens. I felt that women are perceived as less valid than men because God is generally perceived as being male. I then considered the concept of the female God in Mormon theology, the woman who reigns with man in the heavens. The mother in heaven is the goddess, I thought, amazed by the female power inherent in my own familiar but forsaken theology. The mother needs to be revealed to her children, I thought, and she needs to emerge in Mormonism because she is the Mormon deity and a positive cultural social force in the modern world. This realization and need to connect myself to the goddess seemed essential, very basic. I then saw a vision in my mind of a great woman arising from among the masses of women all over the earth, rising up above the hills to form a great image of a woman in the sky. She was the accumulation of all female consciousness and experience. What I didn't say in that column in 1990 was that at the end of the vision, this female world soul spoke to me and said that there was work to be done, a great deal of work to be done, and asked me if I would help. And I naively said, of course. The other thing I did not say was that this woman had appeared to me in dreams and visions over the course of my life since I was a young girl. I never really knew who she was. I just know that she spoke to me in dreams and showed me visions. This woman continued to appear to me in dreams over the course of the next several years as I worked on my book, and guided me and inspired me in that work, and then guided me in 1993, prior to my excommunication. In January of 1993, just 2 weeks after my book came off the press, I had a dream in which she appeared to me. And I finally decided that I needed to ask her who she was, because I had never known her name all these years. And so in the dream, it was sort of a lucid dreaming, I said, "Would you mind telling me your name? Who are you?" And she looked at me with this look of disappointment that immediately communicated to me, "You already know me. You've known me all along. Sophia." And so I set out to discover more about Sophia, who is also known as Wisdom. Over the next few years, I began to look for a place where Sophia was understood and experienced. And I began to look at scriptures and texts dealing with her. And I want to read a few texts and descriptions about this Sophia, or Wisdom. Wise men of old gave the soul a feminine name. Sophia, that is Wisdom, is from the true God, and hath been always with him, and is before all time. Who hath searched out the wisdom of God that goeth before all things? Wisdom has been created before all things, and her understanding is from everlasting. And he poured her out upon all his works and upon all flesh. Sophia, when I sat down to try to describe the Gnostic view of Sophia, which I was led to, I discovered that in the Gnostic tradition, she is held in high esteem. Sophia, in the Gnostic tradition, is the feminine aspect of God, a primary emanation of God, along with the masculine logos or word. Sophia is Wisdom. She represents the part of God that yearns to be human and seeks redemption. She separates from God and enters the material realm. Sophia is the light, shining in the darkness, the divine spark within matter. The descent of Sophia into matter is the story of our own soul's journey into life, our own suffering, reawakening, and redemption. Sophia is the soul or seed of light in humanity, the essential spark of the divine, which is the redeeming power living within each of us. The descent of Sophia into matter represents the existential condition of the human soul in the world, our descent and our distance from God, and our soul's yearning to return home. The fragments of light in all people are collectively the anima mundi, the soul of the world. We cannot ignore the world's pain or humanity, but must find our own sparks of light within it and reawaken our souls to their divinity. This consciousness is the redemption of all creation. I went back to the Bible and looked at a few scriptures, and I realized that as with Mormonism and as with my own life, the Sophia, or the feminine, the divine feminine, had been there all along. And I want to share just a few scriptures. Who is Wisdom? Who is Sophia? Speaking of Jesus, as the child grew and waxed strong in spirit, he was filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was upon him. Again, speaking of Jesus. And when the Sabbath day was come, this is in Mark, that last one was in Luke. In Mark we read, and when the Sabbath day was come, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many hearing him were astonished, saying, from whence hath this man these things? What wisdom is this which is given unto him, that even such mighty works are wrought by his hands? And in Matthew we read, and when he was come into his own country, he taught them in their synagogues, insomuch that they were astonished, and said, whence hath this man this wisdom and these mighty works? And in Matthew we read, the Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, behold, a man gluttonous and a winebibber and a friend of publicans and sinners, but wisdom is justified of her children. I'd like to share just a few more scriptures from Proverbs, the wisdom literature of the Old Testament. I think that when we read the scriptures anew, looking for wisdom or Sophia, we discover that she has been with us all along. In Proverbs 1:20, we read, wisdom crieth without. She uttereth her voice in the streets. She crieth in the chief place of concourse, in the openings of the gates. In the city she uttereth her words, saying, how long, ye simple ones, will ye love simplicity? And the scorners delight in their scornings, and the fools hate knowledge. Turn you at my reproof. I will pour out my spirit unto you. I will make known my words unto you. Because I have called, and ye have refused. I have stretched out my hand, and no man regarded. But ye have set at naught my counsel, and would not at my reproof. But whoso hearkeneth unto me shall dwell safely, and shall be quiet, and free from evil. In Proverbs 8, we read, doth not wisdom cry, and her understanding put forth her voice? She standeth in the top of high places, by the way in the places of the paths. She crieth at the gates of the entry to the city, and at the coming in of the doors. Unto you, O men, I call, and my voice is to the sons of man. O ye simple, understand wisdom. Ye fools, be of an understanding heart. Hear, for I will speak excellent things, and the opening of my lips shall be right things. I love them that love me, and those that seek me early shall find me. Wisdom hath builded her house. She hath hewn out her seven pillars. She hath set forth her maidens. She crieth upon the highest places of the city. Sophia is there, and she has been there all along in my life, in the Mormon church, in the Gnostic tradition, in the scriptures. I'd like to return to that scripture that inspired Joseph Smith to his first vision and read it again, substituting the word Sophia for wisdom. If any of you lack Sophia, let her ask of God, or him ask of God, that giveth to all men and women liberally, and upbraideth not, and it shall be given.
Jana, I do wish John were here. I have learned so much, and I'm so glad I followed his example and asked Mormon women to tell me what they can about the goddess. We have time for one question, and since I asked Hugo to ask a question, if this can be answered quickly, we'll hear from you. But Hugo, since I requested you.
Okay. You outed me. I think we have explored several heretical visions of the divine and our Heavenly Mother and so forth. Let me propose another heretical potential view. Instead of talking about God as male and female, or could we explore the duality of God, of the duality of the divine, perhaps as gay and straight, for example?
Thank you, Hugo. What a remarkable question. I wonder how you came up with that. One of the things, as I started thinking about this, male and female, why are those the only two dualities we work with? They're certainly not the only two we live with. What about the white divine and the black divine, the young divine and the old divine, the gay divine and the straight divine? And one reason I ask Hugo to ask this is I wanted to think about it. I know that in Hinduism there is, I think it's Krishna and Vishnu who end up sleeping together, have a gay relationship. And since I do believe that the divine is metaphorical, what can we learn when we think about that in the universe? That, I mean, we have these sayings, birds of a feather flock together. We also have the saying, opposites attract. How can we think about that which seeks its own and that which seeks its opposite? You know, I don't have answers here. I'm interested in questions. And since I hogged all the time to answer that question, we'll go ahead and... Is that your... Vern, is that what it says? Do you want to go ahead and ask your question?
Yes, I have a question. In Mormon theology, all of the millions of mothers in heaven have bodies, both spiritual bodies with curves and resurrected bodies with curves, very curvaceous. Are there anybody on the panel who actually believes in a literal bodily goddess of another pantheon that has curves, other than the Mormon goddess that has curves, or goddesses that has curves?
Shall I pass the microphone down? Anybody want to address that?
Well, first of all, I believe that if there are many mothers in heaven, then we must have many fathers in heaven. I'm not going to have just one male to many women, which, of course, I guess I am very heretical because I like that question that Hugo asked, and I think that it's good to get out of all of our stereotypes. I think that thinking about gay and straight, I like to think of Heavenly Mother as a black woman, for example. For me, that's a really powerful image, or a Chicana. Those are very powerful images for me to think about Heavenly Mother. What is literal and figurative in the next world? I don't dismiss the possibility that there are real bodily goddesses and that it's all literal, but I think it has to be, if that's true, it has to be so much more than just how we perceive material reality right now. For me, the most fruitful way of approaching this is to try to break open the categories that we already have. So I don't want to be stuck in those. And one of those categories is, I don't believe that only Mormons go to heaven, so there must not be only Mormon gods up there either.
It's a good question, Vern. Joseph Smith's vision of the anthropomorphic, redeemed, glorified human with flesh is...